Welcome to Conservation Unfiltered, a podcast all about the North American model of conservation and your chance to dive into conversations about trends, research, and outdoor activities. It's time to get wild with the 2021 Conservation Media Award-winning host, Jason Creighton.
But what really jumped out was we had 22%, which amounts to millions of college students nationwide when you extrapolate. 22% were potential hunters, which look quite different. This group looked quite different than actual hunters. They were 50% women. They were about 50% minority, non-white. Many of them were from urban areas, and only a handful, less than 20%, were from natural resource majors. So this is a totally different group of students who is interested in hunting, but struggling to find a pathway into it. And that has been a focal point for a lot of our ongoing efforts since then.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Conservation Unfiltered podcast, presented by Conserve the Wild. I'm your host, Jason Creighton, and this is episode number 89, A New Way to Look at R3. Now, today I'm going to be talking with a student-teacher combo, professor-student combo, which is interesting to me as a teacher. But I'm going to be talking with Dr. Lincoln Larson and his student, Tori Vayer. Now, Dr. Lincoln Larson is an associate professor in the Department of Parks, Rec, and Tourism Management at NC State. He's been studying diversity and outdoor recreation with an emphasis on recruitment and retention of non-traditional hunters for the past 15 years. Tori is a student of Dr. Larson. She has a master's in fisheries, wildlife, and conservation biology. Her research is focused on understanding and influencing college students' hunting-related beliefs and the behaviors and human dimensions of natural resources and science communication. That's a whole lot of stuff from both of them to basically say, how can we incorporate more people into hunting? How can we create new hunters, right? That's what R3 is all about. Recruit, retain, reactivate. They're focusing on that recruit part. And you're going to hear just where the largest source of untapped potential hunters is. And I'm not going to spoil it for you. We're going to dive right into it so you can hear where that is. And once you hear it, you're going to say, that makes sense. So let's just dive right in. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Another good episode upcoming. I'm excited for this conversation because we're talking even more about R3. And today's guests are Dr. Lincoln Larson and Tori Vayer. Lincoln, Tori, how are you both?
Doing great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, doing well as well. Thank you for inviting us on this podcast.
So, Tori, you can't get away from Lincoln. You were a former student of Lincoln. How does it feel being on a podcast with him now?
Oh, it's great. I say this all the time, really. Lincoln is a great storyteller, and I think out of all the things I learned through grad school, one of like the most useful skills is becoming a better science storyteller and being able to share the research that we're doing to wider audiences outside of academia is really fulfilling and satisfying, but it's also really nice to be able to talk to people outside of NC State and research universities. And Lincoln does that really well. So as long as he keeps having me back, I'll stick around.
And here I was thinking I'd swept her out the door for good, and she keeps on bouncing back.
So as a teacher, I feel like it's nice whenever students sort of hang out and come around and come back. And it's cool to be able to see you two still interacting and still working together. So we're going to be talking about R3 and a study that you two conducted about R3 and what it means for hunting. But can you, I guess, Lincoln, let's start with you. Can you just give like a real quick brief 10,000 foot overview of sort of current and traditional participation in hunting?
Sure. I suspect many of you out there in the audience are familiar with what the traditional hunting demographic looks like. It's white, it's male, it's older, and it's from rural areas. And that's the way it's been in this country for a long time. You know, if you look at current license sales, even today, you're talking about 90% white, over 90% male, and mostly rural. So that hasn't changed for a long time with respect to hunting. But what is changing is the demographic composition of the United States. Much more urban than it ever has been, obviously much more racial, ethnically diverse than it's ever been. And these transitions, these demographic changes, have totally altered the hunting landscape in the United States. And that has led to a consistent decline since the 1980s in hunting participation and per capita. The percentage of the people who hunt has gone down even more. And state agencies are unsure of what to do next, because even today, 60 to 80% of state agency budgets comes primarily from hunting and fishing license sales and equipment purchases. So without hunting, without that traditional demographic that has fueled hunting, the conservation landscape financially is starting to look pretty bleak. And that is why this R3 recruitment, retention, reactivation movement is taken off in the last decade.
Yeah. So to build off that, Tori, I want to know, why does society need hunting? Like, what, you know, I know Lincoln brought up a little bit about the financials, but what is it about hunting that we need it as part of and in our society here in the United States?
Yeah, that's a great question. And coming from a non-hunting background, my background is all in biological sciences, ecology, that kind of wildlife management side of things. So I'm thinking of why we need, what is the value of hunting, kind of as a three-pronged approach. So Lincoln already mentioned the financial aspect, and obviously that's mega important to agencies, right? We need our state agencies to be funded for other wildlife management and outdoor recreation uses in general. But I think hunting is also really important culturally and traditionally. It has really deep roots in American history, and it's important to not only preserve that, but share it with the current generation of Americans. Hunting has been a part of our American culture since the beginning of the North America we know today. So I think preserving that and kind of updating it as America also grows and updates is really important. And then, like I kind of alluded to in the beginning, as a wildlife management tool, I mean, we've basically gotten rid of all of our apex predators, at least in these suburban, urban environments. We don't really have bears and mountain lions and big predators like we used to when everything was wilderness. So hunting in a lot of places takes the place of having natural predators. And I think that's really important that it's cost effective, and it's a really good tool to use to control those nuisance species that, like, I don't want to hit a deer with my car. I don't think anybody does. I mean, so using hunting as a tool to control species like that is really useful and really effective. And I don't think we can look at hunting only as it's only important because it's a sport and preserve its tradition as a sport. But I think it's important to preserve it as a wildlife management tool as well.
Yeah, bringing up apex predators and the lack of them on the landscape, and as you mentioned, especially in suburban and urban areas, it always, you know, cracks me up whenever, you know, you hear throughout the fall and the winter, a lot of times some people get upset that there is hunting that's going on, but then all of a sudden in the spring, you start seeing as, you know, 1-year-old or year and a half year old bears start dispersing on the landscape, and people start seeing bears in their yards and they don't like that. It's like, well, you know, you can't want the apex predators to do as nature intended and not have hunting, but then at the same time also not want them to be gracing your backyard. That there's got to be a little give and take between all of that. So Lincoln, you mentioned that hunting is declining, or the numbers of people hunting are declining. Is it really? Is that really a thing? Because a lot of hunters would say, no, 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 no. I see just as many, if not more, cars and trucks parked at my hunting spots. Is it are our numbers really going down?
Yes. To answer your question, it's the difference between anecdotal and empirical evidence, right? You can point to any wildlife management area or a hunting lease or anything else, and you'll see tons of hunters out there at any given point in time. But if you look collectively across the entire landscape over an extended period of time, hunter numbers are going down precipitously. And license sales suggest that. Agency budgets indicate that. You know, there's a bit of an uptake and a bit of excitement, honestly, due to the COVID-19 situation. Maybe the one bright spot or one of the few bright spots in the pandemic was this push for outdoor recreation again. But even the numbers we're seeing from that aren't as high as many anticipated. And what I've seen doing a lot of research on parks and other forms of outdoor recreation is if the numbers are going up, it's just the same people coming way more often. And we've seen this in a bunch of national studies, a bunch of statewide studies of park use and outdoor recreation behavior. So it's a mirage, for lack of a better term, perhaps. And I don't think it's anything to hang our hats on. We still need to be very concerned about the future of hunting, the future of conservation, and how we broaden that base of support so that more people feel like they're part of the conservation story.
But just anecdotally, let's say, I want to say it was, I don't know, maybe 5,000 new license sales in Pennsylvania that was attributed to the pandemic. How many, you know, what percentage of those do you think actually stick with hunting if they picked it up for the first time during COVID?
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure anybody knows yet at this point what the answer is, but we do know that one of the most important ingredients to long-term hunting participation, especially for people who adopt hunting later in life as adults, is social support. And that's often what's lacking if you don't come from a hunting family and you're not always around hunting and hunting culture. And so finding ways to develop mentoring programs and other mechanisms along those lines where these newbies can be more firmly embedded in hunting culture and see themselves in hunting is going to be a really critical part of that retention strategy. And that's something that we're finding in a lot of our college programs too.
All right, Tori, I want to start getting into some of the things that you saw from your study. But before we do that, I would like one of you, and I don't know if maybe Lincoln might be a little better for this. I'll leave it up to you two to decide. Just a brief sort of history of what we've seen with the R3 initiatives. Who has taken advantage of R3 initiatives? How have agencies gone about it?
Yeah.
You want me to jump in on that, Tori?
Or
you
go for it. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. I only jump in because I've been working in that space a little bit longer than she has. You know, it varies. There's been a big push really in the last 10, maybe even 5 years to hire R3 positions and develop R3 plans and everything else. What we've been really focused on, or one of our concerns with the R3 push is that it's so focused on numbers, people grab at the lowest hanging fruit, which are lapsed hunters, that is people who used to hunt and have given up. And I know that was a big push in Pennsylvania for a while specifically. So reactivating that group or focusing on kids and getting kids into hunting. But the easiest way to get kids into hunting is to go to 4-H programs and recruit kids who are already part of hunting families and are going to hunt regardless of any sort of programmatic intervention. So it's preaching to the choir kind of stuff that we see a lot as a problem in the R3 movement. So our group has really been focused on branching out and looking at non-traditional pathways into hunting. So women, racial ethnic minorities, urbanites, locavores, you know, people in the local food movement, trying to figure out ways to get entirely new demographic groups engaged in hunting. And, you know, some pathways have shown promise, but not in any significant way to really move the needle with respect to license sales. Again, there's great stories in there, but the big picture is still kind of bleak, frankly. But we think, based on some of our data, that college students and college campuses might be one particularly promising answer. And we can talk more about that as we go forward.
Yeah, so I have always had a little bit of a question when it comes to youth initiatives, because like you said, a lot of times these kids that are I always have some questions regarding the youth initiatives, because as you say, Lincoln, a lot of the kids that take advantage of it are already coming from hunting related families. And so they have that support system to really get youth involved and move the needle. As you say, you have to get youth that aren't coming from hunting based families, and then they're not going to have the support system for hunting than on their own, whether that's financially, transportation, you know, even just access to a place to go. So I always question how well those youth initiatives are actually going to work.
Yeah, I mean, just don't get me wrong. I think they're valuable. And I think they do help a lot of those youth who, you know, become better hunters and become more engaged in hunting. But if the goal is to diversify hunting and broaden hunting participation, that is probably not the answer.
Yeah, that's very well said. So you mentioned college kids, Tori. I mean, I was a college kid, but that feels like a lifetime ago. So Tori, you're a little closer to that. So you mentioned college kids. I was a college kid, but that feels like a lifetime ago. Tori, you're much closer to that. And I feel like that was the majority of your study was sort of focusing on this college student aspect. Can you tell us all a little bit about the study, and then, you know, some of the results that you saw?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we started hinting at it already of these youth programs that have been popping up since the 1980s, 1990s, they are valuable in their own way. But exactly like you said, the kids that go through those programs, they can't own a gun on their own. They can't necessarily even store a gun on their own. Any part of their hunting participation after a workshop has to go through a parent figure or a guardian. Whereas if we target the college student age, they're kind of already primed to try new activities. Like you said, you were a college student once. I think we all remember a little bit of what that's like. You're on a college campus for the first time. And
let's not bring up too many stories from that. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. That's Lincoln and I always joke of, like, there are good new activities to try and there are poor decisions made at the same time. But that is what makes college students such a prime audience for us. It's like kids are already ready to try new things. That is kind of the quintessential college experience, is trying new activities and having the social support where, like, there's no peer pressure like college peer pressure. You get one buddy into something and somehow your whole group is also involved in that. So it's a really unique social atmosphere of, like, college students egging each other on to try these new things. And then also just your mental development stage at that age, the 18 to 24 year old range, you're primed for kind of identity exploration. So we're hoping if we can reach college students at that multiple point in their life where they're really starting to create their own worldviews separate from their parents growing up, if we can target them then, we can make hunting a part of their outdoor recreation lifestyle for the rest of their lives, rather than targeting kids who don't have control over that yet, or potentially older adults who are kind of a little more set in their ways and don't have as much freedom to try new things. So I'm really excited by the promise we've seen from the 18 to 24 college age student range.
Yeah, so I mean, that is a very impressionable age, right? That has that sort of perfect storm of they're trying to find their own identity away from, like you said, their family structure, but they also haven't gotten to the point where they've sort of started their professional lives, where their time is very precious and they might not have a lot of time. So if you can get them interested in hunting before they get to that spot, then they're making time to be outside and participate in hunting so that it's part of their professional life from the very get-go.
I will say all of our groups of students. So we divided students into non-hunters, active hunters, potential hunters, and lapsed hunters. Lincoln, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think all four groups cited a lack of free time as the biggest barrier to hunting participation. So we also understand that time constraints and financial constraints for college students are high. But again, we're hoping that if we can provide the right kinds of opportunities for these students, we can catch them and keep providing that social support, which retains them longer. But that's not to say just because you don't have a 9-to-5 full-time job after college, like these students are definitely overwhelmed with other activities they could be doing, whether it's college sponsored activities or other jobs, other hobbies, things like that. They definitely are citing lack of free time as a big barrier to, I assume, maybe any participation in a new hobby. They're citing a lack of free time, but at least in our survey, that was the biggest barrier to hunting participation.
But if you ask a bunch of active adult hunters, what's the biggest barrier? They'll say the same thing. So, I mean, that's impossible to overcome if you're trying to increase hunting participation, but it is something you need to acknowledge.
Yeah, really, when it comes to trying to increase participation from any demographic, I really, from a time aspect, really, you're trying to convince them to make time to go hunting. You know, I was a lapsed hunter whenever I was in college. I would hunt maybe 2 days a year until my senior year of college, where I felt like I had a little bit more free time, and I made time to go out maybe 6 times that year. And then since getting out of college, after still a couple more years of lapsing, I finally felt like I wanted to make time to go hunting. So I returned sort of to my roots as a more avid hunter at that point. So how can we take sort of the findings of this study and apply them to the R3 movement?
Well, let me rewind for a moment and tell you a little bit more about who was involved in this study. It was a study that was sponsored by Fish and Wildlife Service and Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. And the goal was to really understand, okay, as Tori said, right, there's all these reasons why college students might be a great place to focus for R3 efforts, but nobody's looked into that in any kind of systematic way. And so what we did is we worked with state agencies and universities across 22 states and surveyed, I think it was over 17,000 students at the big public land grant schools like a Penn State, like an NC State, for example, Ohio State, those types of schools across the country, to get a sense of what college students think about hunting specifically and wildlife conservation more broadly. And it was a random sample representative of college campuses these days, which are, a large percentage of them are non-white, are women, of course, are from urban areas. So they're non-traditional pathways into hunting everywhere, millions of students nationwide that fit those attributes. And so we wanted to see what this group nationally thought about hunting across all regions of the country. And that's, so that when we reference our data, that's what we're talking about. And I'll just mention two of the findings that stood out to me, and then Tori, you can elaborate a bit more perhaps. But one was that a bunch of college students, actually about 29%, were past hunters. And that was higher than we anticipated. It's certainly higher than the annual license buying rate of Americans. But keep in mind, a past hunter could have been, they could have gone with as a kid when they were 10 or something with their parents going out one day. Doesn't mean they themselves have purchased a license at any point the way we asked it. And these are also land grant universities that often have ag and natural resource programs. So it's a little bit skewed in that direction. But even so, that's a pretty high number. About 26% said they would keep hunting at some point in the future. And most of those active hunters, not surprising, white males from rural areas. Even though they were younger college students, that's still the demographic. And almost all of them had immediately family members who hunted. But what really jumped out was we had 22%, which amounts to millions of college students nationwide when you extrapolate, 22% were potential hunters, which looked quite different. This group looked quite different than actual hunters. They were 50% women. They were about 50% minority, non-white. Many of them were from urban areas, and only a handful, less than 20%, were from natural resource majors. So this is a totally different group of students who is interested in hunting, but struggling to find a pathway into it. And that has been a focal point for a lot of our ongoing efforts since then.
When you say potential hunters, what do you mean by potential hunters? They're just interested in it or they thought about it? Like, how do we define a potential hunter?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the way we broke it down was we asked students, like Lincoln said, do you have past hunting experience? So that could have been they went hunting once with a family member growing up and they're checking, yes, that they have past hunting experience. We also asked a question about, do you have any interest in hunting in the future? And I believe that one was a 5-point scale. So anybody who said maybe or yes, I want to hunt in the future, we put that those students in the potential hunting group if they didn't have any past hunting experience. So active hunters are, yes, I've hunted in the past. Yes, I will continue hunting in the future. And the potential hunters are, no, I haven't hunted in the past. And yes, or maybe I will hunt in the future.
Okay, so we know, I'm surprised at those percentages. I did not expect, you know, I didn't expect over 10, I would have been happy with 10% of college kids saying that they were interested in hunting or that they had hunted before. So that's surprising to me. So, okay, we have a large number of potential hunters on college campuses. How do we take this research and these findings and how do we apply them to that R3 movement and turn the potential into, yes, they're hunters?
Another great question. I think, honestly, this is probably one of Lincoln and I's favorite questions because this part of the study is just the beginning, which is really, really exciting. Like, we needed to do this study to kind of have a foundation, have a jumping off point for where we want to go in the future. And now that we have the data and the information to say there are potential hunters out there and they're not just white males from rural backgrounds, it's like, okay, what do we do with this information? How do we get those students actually into hunting? Which I think for both Lincoln and I is the really fun and rewarding and exciting part of this. So I don't want to give away too much. We do have some other papers in the works from this research project and they're not published yet. But I think we have to start figuring out kind of what messaging works with different types of students. There's not necessarily going to be a silver bullet that, oh, look, 22% of college students are potential hunters. Here's one message that will recruit all of them at once. No, they're like, it's not homogenous. All of these students come from different backgrounds and have different like cultural awareness of hunting and different past experiences and things like that. So I think next steps are starting to figure out what messaging does work for what types of students. How can we foster social relationships that aren't one-off events? So if we're going to host a workshop, how do we keep mentoring those students for a prolonged period of time rather than just giving them a one-day or two-day workshop and, oh, you're on your own, you're in the hunting world now. Kind of fostering a community and that social support for hunting in a non-intimidating, non-threatening way, I think is going to be really big into not only recruiting diverse college students, but also retaining them to be really valuable members of the hunting community.
And I'll build on that too. Great point, Tori. You know, in terms of the social side, one of the other numbers for that potential hunting group that jumped out to me, 75% of them lack social support for hunting. So they're interested in it, but they really don't have a group or a way to get involved. And that's where the college environment, with support from NGOs, with support from agencies and, you know, faculty and student liaisons on campus, can help bridge the gaps and help create that network that will generate and sustain participation on a campus. And I think, you know, that is something that we really should be thinking heavily about, is how to create peer mentoring networks. How do we, you know, leverage NGO assets to and agency assets to make that happen on a regular basis and sustain some of these programs rather than one-off events. And so I think that's a big piece, is that social piece, especially for that potential hunting group. And then the messaging piece, which Tori said, you know, we had our data said a lot about that too, and what might work and what doesn't. And if you look at active hunters, what motivates them, it's a whole wide range of things. Yes, meat is one, but the social stuff is huge. Many are motivated by the sport and trophy, not a majority, but some are certainly. And if you look at potential hunters, the social stuff, you know, the trophy aspect, that's not even on the radar. It's really about meat, and it's about more altruistic reasons for hunting, supporting conservation, controlling overabundant wildlife populations, something we call civic purpose hunting, which is hunting for the benefit of society. If there's deer, too many deer on the landscape, you know, for example, what might you do there to help? And so it's those conservation, the civic oriented reasons, and the meat reasons that are fueling a desire for these potential hunters to engage. And if we design hunting programs or hunting messages that don't highlight that and that focus too much on, say, the cultural aspects or other things, which is essentially all you see in the media, honestly, then it alienates a lot of these potential hunters and it shuts the door that they were thinking about walking through.
All that information really peaks in my head that some sort of club would just have a huge impact on the college campus, right? Having some sort of hunting type club, people, you know, from the community donating their time to help run those kinds of sort of workshops and then continue to give that social support afterwards. But then as I think about that in the messaging aspect of it, a lot of the issues that I seem to, that I feel like I hear about when it comes to diversifying any area of our society is having someone who looks like me. I wonder if we're trying to diversify, is someone like me who's getting close to middle age and is a white male going to this college campus and saying, hey, does anyone want to learn about hunting? I'll help. I will be your social support group. Does that messaging even help, or should we be trying to incentivize or encourage a more diverse social support group and sort of that way?
I mean, I think yes and no. It's like everything you've said is really important. And I do think there are middle-aged white male hunters that are very, I don't want to say well-spoken, but they're not intimidating. And I'd be, as a non-hunter, a female myself, I'd be totally okay having conversations with some people that I see as hunters. But as a non-hunter, sometimes I walk into a meeting of hunters and I feel immediately out of place. And I feel like all eyes are on me. And it's sometimes my own insecurities making me think, oh, I don't belong in this room. I don't look like everybody else here. So do I think having someone who doesn't look like a middle-aged white man as kind of a spokesperson would be helpful? Sure. But I also think it's really important to make that spokesperson an authentic member of the community. I don't want just a random Latinx folks or Black people up in front of me speaking at me, and I know they're just a figurehead and someone else is talking through them. I want a genuine member of the community who has found their pathway into hunting, not through their own family. I want someone that I can look up to and follow their path rather than feeling like it's an ingenuine figurehead that I'm talking to, if that makes sense, which I think is partially why I have found a place in this study as well, is when we're recruiting students to do some of our workshops here in North Carolina, I think it is really helpful for me to go into college classrooms and say, hey, look, I'm not a hunter. 2 years ago, I didn't know anything about hunting. I'm a 5 foot tall woman who knows nothing about this, and I'm going to be there. If you see yourself in me, come out and join me. Like, it feels a little less intimidating, in my opinion. But I should also say that's mostly anecdotal evidence from my experiences. That's not necessarily something we've seen through the numbers. Lincoln, I don't know if you have anything else to add. I just really like to stress that I want those relationships and like the community club type relationships to be as authentic and genuine as possible. I don't think we get super far from kind of token diversity, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'd add to that is that it's just authenticity is key. Anybody can be an ambassador. You know, is it easier to connect with a certain group if you look like that group and demographically fit in with that group? Absolutely. It's very hard. You know, we're thinking now about launching our three programs at HBCUs in the Southeast, historically Black colleges and universities, to think about the historical connection that population has had, particularly in the Southeast, with hunting and how that's been lost as urbanization has progressed and everything else. And you know, am I, as a white male, the best person to come in and do that? Probably not. But if you try to engage in an authentic way and you're genuinely concerned about, you know, bringing new people into this exciting lifestyle or pursuit, you know, I think that's still meaningful. And it would help to have a partner or somebody else involved that fits in better demographically with that group. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't try, or that you shouldn't at least try to branch out and find others who can help you to accomplish those goals.
Yeah, and especially with college kids, they call a spade a spade. You know, if you're just trying to diversify, show diversity for the sake of diversity, I like that, being authentic. And, you know, if I walk in and into an area, into a group, and, you know, it's a diverse group, and I'm just my regular authentic self and accepting of everyone there, I personally feel like they would be more accepting to that than if I just, you know, grabbed, you know, my Latinx friend to come with me and just, he says what I tell him to say. It's not going to have the same effect.
Well, and to that point too, Jason, it made me think of something else. I've been thinking a lot in terms of how we talk about hunting with different populations. And I think we shouldn't be talking, we should be listening. And I think that's the biggest problem that a lot of us face is, we're so dead set on spreading the gospel of hunting and all the benefits and why everybody should be doing it. But there are all these different pathways, and our experience is not someone else's. And that's what we've seen in talking to these college students and running a lot of the programs that we've been running, is that they're just very different pathways. And until you actually sit back and listen and ask someone why they're here, what they're looking for, you start understanding why, you know, a lifelong vegan is suddenly eating game meat. And you're like, WTF, what's going on here? This is bizarre. But it's all about ecological footprint. It's just one example. And just taking the time to listen and reflect and try to understand different perspectives can make us all much more effective communicators. And it makes the hunting community far more inviting than it has been traditionally, as, you know, an intentionally defined exclusive group. And until we start listening, we're not going to change that dynamic.
Yeah, you know, in a past episode last year, I had Robbie Kroger on of Blood Origins, and his big thing is asking people why they hunt. And he had asked me that question, even though I was interviewing him, and he's such a great interviewer. It's like, okay, you have the floor, you ask me. And, you know, yeah, I can give, you know, the quick 3-minute answer, but that doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of all the different intricacies of why I hunt, which I then turned those thoughts in my mind into a 40-minute long episode of why I hunt, which still was barely scratching the surface of why I actually hunt and everything that goes into it. So, you know, I love that you're saying we need to listen, because if you have someone that has a passing interest in hunting, if you can find out what their motivations are for that, I feel like they'll definitely feel more included. It's not a, this is the way you hunt, this is why you hunt. It's, why do you want to hunt and what way do you want to do it? I love that. Now, I have to say this, because this is, you know, the United States. We are a diverse people. We are sometimes a divided people. And this is just another topic that can be a little bit divided. Do you see any potential issues or negatives to diversifying the hunting population?
No, is my short answer to that. Not in the long term. Sure, you know, there's going to be kickback anytime you see a change to the status quo. Certain groups, certain populations aren't going to feel comfortable with that. And that's a natural reaction. And, you know, we certainly understand that. But the reality is, if hunting is going to persist on this landscape, the American landscape, and if agencies are going to continue to rely on hunting as a primary source of funding for all their wildlife management activities, then if we don't try, we have failed, because there's no other way, with the demographic change that's happening, there's no other way to sustain hunting as a part of American culture and as a part of the conservation landscape unless we broaden the base of support for hunting and engagement of hunting. It can't continue to look like the traditional hunting population. And, you know, people out there may not like to hear that, but that's reality. And if we, you know, retreat to our silos and we continue to build walls to prevent change from happening, then we'll be hung out to dry, as will hunting, and that important piece of American culture will all be lost.
Yeah, if I could add to that for a second too, I think, like we mentioned right in the very beginning, our state agencies are primarily funded through this right now. And I think Lincoln and I have talked about this a lot, and this is maybe a conversation for another time as well. Like, we can't cover it all in a 1 hour podcast, but the conservation landscape doesn't have to be solely based on hunting. Like, we should, hunting is not the only solution to our conservation issues. We are obviously doing this work because we do think hunting is a really important part of the conservation landscape, but it doesn't have to be the only solution. So building off of that as well, we had 50% of our sample identified as non-hunters. They have never been hunting and they don't have a desire to hunt in the future. But the approval of hunting, especially for meat and for ecological altruistic reasons, the approval of hunting is quite high, even among these students who are identifying as non-hunters. So isn't there a way we can leverage that hunting advocate attitude? We should be able to use those students who don't want to actively participate themselves and bring them into the conservation conversations as well. It, like, I just don't think hunting is the only answer here. It's a long-winded way around your question, but I don't think diversity in the hunting community is the only solution if we're thinking strictly about people who pull the trigger themselves. There are other routes into the hunting community and being a part of the hunting community, even if you don't pull the trigger yourself, and they're still valuable assets to conservation. And I guess my final, like, my big 30,000 foot view answer of that question is, I think there's more common ground among all of us than we think. I mean, most of us, whether you're a non-hunter or a hunter, we care about conservation. We're all here because we really like conservation. So again, isn't there a way we can leverage that piece of all of us and understand that whether you're a non-hunter or hunter, we're fighting the same fight here. And together, we're going to do a lot better than if we keep alienating non-hunters for being non-hunters and alienating hunters for being rural white men. Like, we're not solving anything by working at it this way.
No, I think that's well said. You know, as someone who's an avid hunter, who considers myself a conservationist, you know, I pride myself on the fact that hunters are a financial backbone of my state agency's, you know, conservation efforts. And I look at the diversity, you know, I look at diversifying hunting as a total win-win. If I'm going to pride myself on providing financially for conservation efforts, then why would I be mad that another 1 or 10 or 100 or 1,000 people bought hunting licenses that are going to financially fund conservation efforts? Like, I should pride myself in more people hunting. And that's one of the goals I have with this podcast, and what I'm trying to do here is just try to get more people involved and more people wanting to give back to conservation. And whether that's financially or boots on the ground work or hunting, whatever it is, any little bit is going to help. And if that comes from, you know, an African American or a woman or someone who's transgender, I don't care. None of that matters to me. If someone's buying a hunting license, the only label I need to put on them is that they are a hunter, and the rest of their background does not matter. That's a way that would just be one more way that person and myself are alike. And if we look, like you said, Tori, if we look at that kind of stuff, if we're looking at what we have in common, as opposed to what divides us, what makes us different, that's just going to make us a better society in general, let alone having more hunters in the woods and more conservation funding and more people accepting of hunting. So Lincoln, Tori, anything else, last sort of big ideas, comments that we didn't talk about that you're like, hey, I got to make sure that this gets out there that people know about?
I just have one addition to what you just said. It brought up another thought in my head. I think, again, Lincoln and I go back and forth on some of this all the time. We've heard anecdotally some pushback from hunters saying, but I don't want my land to be more crowded. My land is already crowded. And I'm like, okay, that's not a problem of having more hunters. That's a problem of not having enough public land and not having enough access to public land. Again, if non-hunters stay non-hunters and they just want to use the land for outdoor recreation, we still need more public land and we need more access and opportunities to use that land. So again, I just think that argument to me is kind of like ironic and funny that we have hunters saying, my land's already too crowded. I don't want to share the land with more people. Yeah, I want hunting. I want to recruit new hunters and I want it to be important, but I don't want it on my land because that takes away from my sport. And I'm like, okay, but that's not a problem with the other people. It's a problem with we need more public land and access to land. So I like that argument because I'm always down to get more public land in this country.
100%. Or if, you know, sometimes public land sometimes isn't always the easiest thing to add on to, although access onto established public land is something that the canon has been done recently. But even just, private land open to sportsmen. North Dakota has a great program, the Plots Program, that's what it's titled, that my father-in-law, myself and my father, that's what we hunted last fall whenever we went to North Dakota was plots land. We have a very similar program here in Pennsylvania, just getting more people who don't hunt their land or are open to hosting people on their land to open up the doors for themselves. That I'm so glad you brought up the access piece. That is the biggest crutch to the R3 movement. I don't want to hear anyone say that there's too many hunters in a spot. Let's just give more access. And then that alleviates that. Lincoln, what do you got?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I'm laughing in the background here. I would say, in terms of next steps in this R3 work focus on college students, we've been doing a lot. This, as Tori alluded to, this is just a tip of the iceberg, understanding the landscape. We've actually been running programs for first-time hunters who are college students in a number of these states, I think 16 different states. And we just finished up that round in the past 2 years, derailed a bit by the pandemic, but we still managed to power through in most states. Trying to understand, is this creating new hunters? Or if not new hunters, at least new hunting advocates, or people who would support hunting in the future. And the preliminary results suggest that it is in a big way. But we certainly see, some programs that have a stronger mentoring component, for example, more opportunities to hunt with peers, tend to be doing a little bit better in terms of that. And so we've got a few models now, including an academics of field model that's led by the Georgia Wildlife Federation in states across the Southeast, which is more cohort based. So instead of a workshop here and there followed by a hunt, the same group of students follows the program throughout the course of the year to see if that works. And so we're trying different models, trying to find ways that work, and every state's going to be different, but it does require investment and commitment from partners within the state, whether it's an agency, whether it's an NGO or a university, to all be on the same page. And I think that's the first step in this fruitful process. And then the other thing I'll add at the end here is, and Tori said this too, but I'll just reiterate, we're talking all about hunting today, and we're thinking about the future of conservation, the role that hunting plays, but diversifying hunting and increasing the number of hunters is just one solution to a lot of these problems we've talked about. And there are whole other ways to do it. We could change the way conservation is funded. We could change the way the public engages with state agencies in terms of, who are the stakeholders? Is it truly all members of the public, including those who don't hunt and fish? Or is it just hunters and anglers? And we all know that historically, it's really just been those last two groups. And I think if we're going to turn the page and really kind of open up the doors and welcome all types of people into this this endeavor that is public land conservation and wildlife conservation, we need to be more open-minded about who should be at that table and how to get them there. And recruiting new hunters who are diverse is an important part of that process, but there are a lot of other pieces of that story that we should all be thinking about.
I think that's well said on both of your ends. Thank you, Lincoln. Thank you, Tori, for coming on to talk about this. I'm excited to read, and I'll be looking out for the new publications of how the different programs have worked out across the nation with the different colleges. I'm excited to see how this works, and like you said, Tori, there's no silver bullets, but I'm curious to see which works where and how I can help myself more than just being an advocate, but actually try to give back as well. So thank you both for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Please feel free to reach out to us if you've got ideas or questions about R3, particularly R3 efforts involving college students.
Another episode is in the books. You've heard it in past episodes. You've seen it on our social media pages. I've spouted this off as much as I possibly can, and I need to shout it from the rooftops and continue to bring people like Dr. Larson and Tori on to talk about this. Not only do we need more hunters, right? More hunters means more hunting dollars in our current structure of funding conservation in our country. Not only do we need more hunters, we need to diversify our hunters. We need to make sure we are pulling from the largest source possible, which turns out is college campuses, right? For potential hunters. That's awesome. That makes sense once you hear it, but it's not something I thought about. Youth movements are great, right? For those young kids, that's great. Trying to get adult hunters, that's great. Different organizations can take different approaches and they can all help a little bit. But those college kids, they're trying to find themselves. If we can give them that activity then, and they say, they see themselves in that activity and they say, ah, that's it. That's what I want to do as a hobby for the rest of my life. Oh, man, it's pulling lots of dollars in. And it's a diverse source, right, of different backgrounds that people are coming from, that these kids, these students are coming from. And that's what we need, right? If we continue to try to just make hunting work with the rural, white, middle-aged man, right, me, right? If all I do is recruit other people that look like me and that are me, we're going to die. We're not going to have enough. We're not going to be able to sustain. So we need to bring in other people, right? Women, people of color, people from the cities, people from suburban areas. It doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter. And where can we find all these people mixed in together? College campuses. College campuses. Makes sense once you hear it. It really, really makes sense. I'm curious to hear all your thoughts on this. Do we need to diversify? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you have a way that you think might work? Is there a way that you can help where you have helped? Reach out to us and let us know. The easiest way, join the Conservation Unfiltered podcast Facebook page. Okay? Find that page, join up, like it, join that group, and let us know what you think. I'm curious. I want to know. I think it's a great idea. Maybe you do too. Let's get together and let's figure out how we can really help this wonderful tradition thrive moving forward. And then until we figure out that, and also, you know, how to bring about world peace, make sure you're staying wild.